The subject of this lesson is Genesis chapter 20, where we read of faith returning to depart. Let us read the chapter. And Abraham journeyed from thence toward the south country, and dwelt between Kadesh and Shur, and sojourned in Gerar. And Abraham said of Sarah his wife, "She is my sister." And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. But God came to Abimelech in a dream by night, and said to him, "Behold, thou art but a dead man, for the woman which thou hast taken, for she is a man's wife." But Abimelech had not come near her, and he said, "Lord, wilt thou slay also a righteous nation? Said he not unto me, 'She is my sister,' and she, even she herself said, 'He is my brother.' In the integrity of my heart and innocency of my hands have I done this." And God said unto him in a dream, "Yea, I know that thou didst this in the integrity of thy heart, for I also withheld thee from sinning against me, therefore suffered I thee not to touch her. Now therefore, restore the man his wife, for he is a prophet, and he shall pray for thee, and thou shalt live. And if thou restore her not, know thou that thou shalt surely die, thou and all that are thine." Therefore Abimelech rose early in the morning, and called all his servants, and told all these things in their ears, and the men were sore afraid. Then Abimelech called Abraham, and said unto him, "What hast thou done unto us? And what have I offended thee, that thou hast brought on me and on my kingdom a great sin? Thou hast done deeds unto me that ought not to be done." And Abimelech said unto Abraham, "What sawest thou that thou hast done this thing?" And Abraham said, "Because I thought, surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they will slay me for my wife's sake. And yet indeed she is my sister, for she is the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother. And she became my wife. And it came to pass, when God caused me to wander from my father's house, that I said unto her, 'This is thy kindness which thou shalt show unto me. At every place whither we shall come, say of me, "He is my brother."'" And Abimelech took sheep and oxen and men servants and women servants and gave them unto Abraham and restored him Sarah his wife. And Abimelech said, "Behold, my land is before thee, dwell where it pleaseth thee." And unto Sarah he said, "Behold, I have given thy brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Behold, he is to thee a covering of the eyes, and to all that are with thee, and with all other." Thus she was reproved. So Abraham prayed unto God, and God healed Abimelech and his wife and his maidservants, and they bare children. For the Lord had fast closed up all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. After the amazing events of chapter 18, and the solemnity of what took place over Sodom and Gomorrah, it is with some amazement that we read the words of chapter 20. Here we find Abraham repeating the mistakes of chapter 12, and going down to the south country, repeating the lies which he had told in Egypt regarding his wife. It seems scarcely credible to us that such deception would be seen again in the life of Abraham. And yet, here we have it, plainly to see. What lesson can we learn from these events? Let us ask a few questions. The first question is, why did he journey? Why did he move again into a sphere where he would fall into the old habit of lying? Why did he not remain where he was and wait on the Lord? He well knew that he was once again descending to conduct which was unacceptable to the Lord. He well knew he had suffered in the past because of this kind of behavior. So why did he go down this time? One possible answer is that he was overcome with despair by what had happened to Lot. He We know from his intercession before the Lord that although Lot had left him and gone to Sodom, Abraham still felt dearly for him. There was still in his heart a longing for Lot. He had shared so much together, and now Lot had lost so much in the overthrow of the city. It may be that this feeling was increased by the fact that Lot had not come to him after fleeing the judgment of God. Sometimes despair can overwhelm us when we look at the failures of others and at the price they have to pay for their folly. If it is someone who is dear to us, it is made all the harder to bear. We see a dear one in the sad condition in which Lot found himself. And for us, as for Abraham, it is hard to bear. David felt the same feelings as he mourned for Absalom after his death. There can come into our hearts a feeling that it is not worth going on, and that our attempts to be obedient to the Lord have yielded no fruit. Spiritual depression can soon come in, and we lose touch with the Lord. Perhaps Abraham reproached himself because it was he who had introduced him to Egypt all these years ago, and it was the taste of that country into which he had led Lot that gave him a desire to go to Sodom. Such a feeling would add to Abraham's feeling of despair at what had taken place. Another, if only, to add to the sadness which was enveloping him. Another possible reason is that once again he felt disappointment that the promises of God were not being fulfilled. How long had he to wait? How long was the Lord to keep him waiting for the promised son? Once again we see how difficult it can be to wait on the Lord, and how prone we are to wander during the time of waiting. In all this we see a man who still has faith, but is no longer living in the good of it. He knows that God will not let him down, but somehow or other he has let the goodness of the promise go. He has slipped once again and seeks to find more congenial surroundings in another area. It has been the experience of some believers to try and solve the problem of lack of spiritual appetite by moving to another area, or even by moving to another country. But they all find that the basic problem cannot be solved that way. Moving house or moving country does not change my spiritual condition, and I will only take my lack of interest with me. The problem has to be solved in the sanctuary, not at the estate agent or at the travel agent. Let us learn again the lesson that enjoyment of the Lord and his promises is something that we can lose very quickly. It does not survive on its own without attention from us. It has to be nourished in the sanctuary and watered by faith constantly. These are two possible reasons why Abraham suddenly returns to an old sin. The next question which we ask is, where did he go? Look at the map and you will see that he did not go as far as in chapter 12. He did not go right down to Egypt, but stopped short in the south country between Kadesh and Shur. He was obviously aware of the dangers of Egypt. That much he had not forgotten. But he was apparently oblivious to the dangers of where he now stopped. Abraham could salve his conscience by saying that he had resisted the temptation of Egypt this time, but he did not appreciate that the basic problem was still there. He would still tell lies. The lesson for us is that we may salve our conscience by telling ourselves that we have stopped short of the excesses to which we went the last time, but the sin is just the same, and there is only distress as a result. The next question which I want to ask is, what did he do? I suppose there is a familiar ring about what he did when he got to the far country. The first thing to notice is that he told only half the truth as far as Sarah was concerned. The repetition of the old lie, "She is my sister," was half the truth. But hide, he would, the vital fact from them that she was his wife. The relationship was not the close one of brother and sister, but she was related to Abraham. We have seen this in chapter 12, and we do not need to run over these lessons once again. One thing which we must note, however, is that Abraham is quite content to return to old sins. The fact that he had conquered a particular sin and felt that it no longer had any power over him was probably still with him. But that must not be the basis of our thinking, because if we think that way, pride comes in and the old sin attacks us once again. This sin had not reared its head for years, but here it was again, gaining the ascendancy over Abraham, no matter how much he had been taught in the intervening years. There was no excuse now on the basis of inexperience or of immaturity. 23 years or so had passed since the last time he had uttered these words, and long times with God had been spent during these 23 years. But despite that, he returns to the sin of the past. The second thing to notice is that Abraham showed no concern for the Philistines among whom he was now dwelling. Back in Egypt, when he told his lie, the Lord plagued the house of Pharaoh with great plagues, and so the court suffered because of Abraham. This lesson must have been remembered, but Abraham seems to be unconcerned about what might happen to the Philistines. Sin can take away our sensitivity concerning others, and there certainly here was no concern that they might suffer. But observe also that Abraham showed no concern for Sarah in this matter. He was effectively delivering her into the hand of the Philistines, and that cannot be seen as other than a sinful and callous act. It seems that Sarah was even prepared to go along with this, for Abimelech states to the Lord that she had said, "He is my brother." She seems to be as blind to the potential disaster as does Abraham. Sin soon takes care not only of the conscience, but of our ability to think clearly and rationally. So, past lessons are forgotten in the concern about self-preservation. In life, you may be met with a situation which you have encountered before, and in which you know that you sinned. The answer this time seems so easy, and yet you know that it is also sinful. Turn away from such a course, and put all your trust in the Lord to deal with the matter. What was sinful before is equally sinful today. What brought discipline before from the hand of God will bring discipline today. The next question to ask is, how was he delivered? Sarah has now been taken into the court of the king of the Philistines, and soon he will come and take her. What danger she is in! And we must ask how she was preserved. Abraham did not go to her aid, and we wonder what was passing through his mind at this time. The lie has been told. His wife has been taken, and yet he does nothing. He does not go to the king and confess his sin as a means of saving Sarah from this disaster. Sarah must have been a most attractive woman, but Abraham is sacrificing her for his own preservation. We see with wonder that it was the Lord who moved to preserve Sarah. It was only due to the restraining hand of the Lord that the king had not taken Sarah. "I withheld thee from sinning against her," is what the Lord tells the king. What a sad sight there is as the king speaks to Abraham. Here, a believer is seen to be less righteous than an unbeliever, and this should never be so. The king of the Philistines had acted in the integrity of his heart, and with no intention of taking another man's wife. He had been truthful in the whole matter, whereas Abraham had been dishonest. It sometimes can be that in pursuit of selfish ends, believers act in a way that is abhorrent to the world. It never should be, but sadly it can take place. Whoever would have thought it of Abraham? But we have seen today that he stands guilty. May we never be so. After having considered all these sad events, we are faced with the question, why was it allowed? If the Lord stepped in to restrain the king of the Philistines, why did he not step in earlier and prevent the whole sorry saga taking place? To get the answer to that, we have to turn our attention to verses 11 to 13. When speaking to Abimelech, Abraham tries to justify his actions, but in so doing confesses an old sin. This had been lying in the background for years. Abraham speaks of when he left Ur of the Chaldees and reveals that at that time he and Sarah had made a pact that when there was danger to Abraham's life, because Sarah's beauty attracted other men, she would say that she was his sister, thus ensuring that Abraham's life was not in danger. "This is thy kindness, which thou shalt show to me," was how he put it to her. Hardly an edifying sight to see Abraham scheming and conniving like this. But notice the language which he uses of that call. He speaks of, "when God caused me to wander from my father's house." What language is this? Is this not a low appreciation of the call of the God of glory? Yes, when he was down in the south country, his heart was not right with God, and the call seems just to be the start of years of wandering. The very use of the word indicates a purposeless moving about. Was that the life for which he was called from out of the Chaldees? These words should certainly never have been used of the great call to go into the land which God would tell him of. When our hearts are like the heart of Abraham at this time, the call of the gospel loses its appeal. We forget what we were called for. We forget the purpose of it all, and our conduct shows just how dim is our appreciation of the Lord. But the reason why this was allowed was to bring Abraham to the point where he would confess that old sin. The pact which husband and wife had made had led to such trouble. Interesting to see that they were heeding the call of God at that time, all these years ago, but while doing so they had prepared their own security system. They had courses of actions worked out to put into action when they felt that the Lord would not act, despite the fact that he was calling them from out of the Chaldees. Is not this just like us? We follow the Master, but we keep contingency plans up our sleeve just in case we do not like what is about us and where he has called us to. We make provision to make up for our own failure instead of casting all things on the Lord. Did Sarah and Abraham not realize all these years ago that the Lord would take care of them? All they had to do was to walk in ways pleasing to him, to be obedient, and he would stay the hand of their enemies and preserve their lives. How could he ever be slain when he had been promised that he would be the father of a son? Let us be rid of all the baggage of self-help, that which is not dependent on the Lord. Like Abraham, it can only give us trouble and land us in sad circumstances. Trust the Lord. He knows best. And let us not be found preparing a fallback course of action against the possibility of the Lord not taking care of us. We will find, like Abraham, that putting into action the course of self-help brings nothing but sorrow and difficult circumstances into our lives, which will compromise our testimony. If we claim that he is the Lord whom we follow and who cares for his children, how can we reconcile that with making up our own, perhaps dishonest, system of caring for ourselves? We now come to Genesis chapter 21, where the birth of Isaac is recorded. Let us now read the chapter. And the Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did unto Sarah as he had spoken, for Sarah conceived and bare Abraham a son in his old age, at the set time of which God had spoken to him. And Abraham called the name of his son that was born unto him, whom Sarah bare to him, Isaac. And Abraham circumcised his son Isaac, being 8 days old, as God has commanded him. And Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born unto him. And Sarah said, God hath made me to laugh, so that all that hear will laugh with me. And she said, who would have said unto Abraham that Sarah should have given children suck, for I have borne him a son in his old age? And the child grew, and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast the same day that Isaac was weaned. And Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, which she had borne unto Abraham, mocking. For she said unto Abraham, cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, even with Isaac. And the thing was very grievous in Abraham's sight because of his son. And God said unto Abraham, let it not be grievous in thy sight because of the lad, and because of thy bondwoman. In all that Sarah hath said unto thee, hearken unto her voice, for in Isaac shall thy seed be called. And also of the son of the bondwoman will I make a nation, because he is thy seed. And Abraham rose up early in the morning, and took bread and a bottle of water, and gave it unto Hagar, putting it on her shoulder, and the child, and sent her away, and she departed and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba. And the water was spent in the bottle, and she cast the child under one of the shrubs. And she went and sat down over against him a good way off, as it were a bowshot, for she said, let me not see the death of the child. And she sat over against him and lifted up her voice and wept. And God heard the voice of the lad, and the angel of God called to Hagar out of heaven, and said unto her, what aileth thee, Hagar? Fear not, for God hath heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad, and hold him in thine hand, for I will make him a great nation. And God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water, and she went and filled the bottle with water, and gave the lad drink. And God was with the lad, and he grew and dwelt in the wilderness, and became an archer, and he dwelt in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took him a wife out of the land of Egypt. And it came to pass that time that Abimelech and Phicol, the chief captain of his host, spake unto Abram, saying, God is with thee in all that thou doest. Now therefore swear unto me here by God, that thou wilt not deal falsely with me, nor with my son, nor with my son's son, but according to the kindness that I have done unto thee, thou shalt do unto me and to the land wherein thou hast sojourned. And Abraham said, I will swear. And Abraham reproved Abimelech because of a well of water, which Abimelech's servants had violently taken away. And Abimelech said, I wot not who hath done this thing. Neither didst thou tell me, neither yet heard I of it, but today. And Abraham took sheep and oxen, and gave them unto Abimelech, and both of them made a covenant. And Abraham set 7 ewe lambs of the flock by themselves. And Abimelech said unto Abraham, What mean these 7 ewe lambs which thou hast set by themselves? And he said, For these 7 ewe lambs shalt thou take of my hand, that they may be a witness unto me that I have digged this well. Wherefore he called that place Beersheba, because there they sware both of them. Thus they made a covenant at Beersheba. Then Abimelech rose up, and Phicol, the chief captain of his host, and they returned into the land of the Philistines. And Abraham planted a grove in Beersheba, and called there on the name of the Lord, the everlasting God. And Abraham sojourned in the Philistines' land many days. At last, after many years, the birth of a son for Abraham through Sarah becomes a reality. How long he had waited for this, and now it takes place. There are a number of lessons which we can learn from this chapter. The first lesson to be learned is of the faithfulness of God. It had been many years since the promise had been given, but God is faithful, and now the promise is fulfilled. How many promises in the Bible are given to us, and we can rest on the certainty that every single one of them, without exception, will be fulfilled. It would be impossible to go through the Word of God and pick out all the great and precious promises left to us, but God will fail in none of them. Why are these promises there? They are there firstly because they are encouragement to us. In the difficulties of life, it is of great value to think of the promises which heaven has laid before us. They shine as a beacon on a dark day. They comfort the sorrowing. They give strength to the weary. They lift up the despondent and those who are cast down. What a great encouragement comes from the promises of God. Thus we are promised God's peace in our hearts if we pray. Thus we are told that we can cast all our burdens on Him, for He cares for us. But they not only encourage us, they test us. Do we really believe the promises of God? We have seen how Abraham behaved at times, even although he was a man of faith. Sometimes these promises, as was in the case of Abraham, defy human logic. They tell us to believe what cannot, from a human point of view, take place. Do we believe God rather than the teaching of men? How could anyone as old as Abraham and Sarah have a child? How can the rapture take place and millions leave earth in a moment and be taken to glory? How can God supply all our need when we are giving of our resources to others? It is a test of our faith in Him to accept and believe every promise which He makes. Another reason why He makes His great promises is to cause us to worship Him. When we see them fulfilled, we are filled with wonder and with worship. When we realize that the impossible has taken place. Worship surely is the result of seeing God at work in this way. The second lesson which we wish to learn is concerning the fruitfulness of Abraham. The great age of Abraham is noted in this chapter. He was 100 years of age, and he was fruitful in his old age. What a great encouragement this is to us all. No matter how old we are, we can still be fruitful in the things of God. This is not confined to the young, but can be the experience of all. When the years advance and we realize that the greater part of our life is behind us, we need not give up and think that our days of service for the Master are over, or that the great days of service are all behind us. Not at all. there can still be great things done for him, and we can still be fruitful for the Master. Notice, please, that this fruitfulness gave Sarah great joy. It is recorded in verse 6 that she said, "God hath made me to laugh." The last time she laughed, it was in unbelief. But this has now been turned to the joy of belief, the joy of promises realized. Notice also that this joy is to be shared by others. For all who hear her will laugh with her. So joy is infectious, and a joyful heart influences others. There is something about joy which wants to pass it on to others, and Sarah feels this need in her soul. In considering Abraham's fruitfulness, we must not, however, lose sight of a vital, important lesson. From a human point of view, both Abraham and Sarah were dead. At their advanced years, there was no hope of their giving birth. And then, blessing came. The simple lesson is that only when man is dead can God act in power. What do we mean by this statement? It is clear that we do not mean that when man is physically dead. We mean that when he is finished with this world, when he has reached the end of all his resources, and when he sees the folly of all his worldly ambitions, only then God acts in power. Is this not what took place with Jacob at Peniel when he wrestled with the man? Is this not what Paul had in mind when he told the Colossians, "For ye are dead, and your life is hid with Christ in God"? To the Colossians he was speaking of a spiritual fact, but they had to come into the good of that. Only when we come to an end of ourselves and recognize that our power is finished, and only his power in us can bring about anything for his glory, only then can we know his power in our service for him. The birth of Isaac was to parents who were past childbearing age. The promise was fulfilled and owed nothing to Abraham or to Sarah. It owed everything to God. The third point which we must consider after the faithfulness of God and the fruitfulness of Abraham is the folly of Ishmael. When what is of God is born, we are not surprised to find a bad reaction from the flesh. Ishmael's birth was the result of the work of the flesh, and Isaac's birth was the result of the work of God. Therefore, there is a bad reaction from Ishmael. So it was, when the Lord Jesus was here, that his presence brought out the very worst in men, and finally they crucified him. So it is in our own lives, that if we let the flesh take control, we will find that what is of God does not please us, but causes us to react badly against it. The actions of Ishmael may not be thought of as very serious. We find him in verse 9 mocking Isaac. Isaac has been weaned. He is growing. And Ishmael looks at the younger child and feels nothing but contempt for him. Thus he mocks him and makes fun of him. As I say, you may not think that this is a very serious course of action for Ishmael to take. But we must turn to the New Testament to see the comment there on what had taken place. In Galatians chapter 4, verse 29, we read, "But as then he that was born after the flesh persecuted him that was born after the Spirit, even so it is now." This refers to Ishmael persecuting Isaac. So the mocking of Ishmael was not a matter which was overlooked by God. Ishmael was making jest of Isaac, laughing at him, seeking to make him look like an object of fun. God regarded this as persecution, a fact which we would all do well to remember. It is a serious matter to trifle with what is of God, and in Galatians we are told that Ishmael persecuted Isaac. Let us not laugh at or mock in any way those who are serving the Lord. Sometimes this can be done out of jealousy, sometimes because we may not agree on some course of action. Whatever we do, let us not laugh and mock, either in the presence of the one who you are treating with derision, or behind the back of those about whom you are speaking. Let us say again that the Lord treats this as a very serious matter indeed. It is seen as persecution. The young Isaac would feel this keenly, as his older half-brother poured scorn upon him. But the Lord was taking account of all that was happening. Sarah sees what is taking place, and this time her advice is right. It is good advice. Cast out the bondwoman and her son. The Lord will confirm to Abraham that this is what has to take place. He who persecutes those who belong to the Lord will find that there is a price to be paid. Abraham has learned one important lesson from the past, whereas previously he had taken the advice of Sarah without waiting on a word from the Lord, and Ishmael had been the result. And as he had left Hagar and Ishmael in the hands of Sarah, and she had cast them out wrongly, now Abraham waits on the Lord before he acts in any way. Only when the Lord speaks to him does he cast them out from the home. What lessons are to be learned from this? We must remember that he did send them out with some provision for the way, and the Lord took care of them and promised that a great nation would come from Ishmael. The purpose of casting him out was not therefore that he and his mother would die. It was, however, evidence of the fact that Ishmael and Isaac could not live together. Let us learn a number of lessons from this. The first is that what is of the flesh cannot coexist with what is of the spirit. Isaac was, as we have already noted, the work of God, whereas Ishmael was the work of the flesh. These cannot exist together in our lives. The Lord is showing us here that drastic action is necessary to cast out the work of the flesh from our lives. If we seek to see what is of God grow, we must get rid of what is of the flesh. We should, of course, ask what we mean by the expression, the flesh. It is enough in this lesson to say that it is work that is not done in faith. It is what we do when we are disobedient to the Lord. It is the fruit of our actions when we are acting like the unsaved, like the unregenerate. Now let us say again that these two, the work of the flesh and the work of the spirit, cannot live together in my life. I do not mean that we never sin, but I do mean that if the whole thrust and bent of our lives is to live as if we had never been saved, and to see only the fruit of the flesh, and to act as the world acts, well, there will be no growth of the things of God in my life. You, listener, must decide what kind of life you wish to live. The second lesson to be learned is found in Paul's epistle to the Galatians. In that epistle, Ishmael is brought before us as a picture of the law, and Isaac as a picture of grace. Read Galatians chapter 4, verses 21 to 31 to see the lessons. What are they? It clearly states that these two are an allegory. That is, they are an illustration of the law and grace. We learn also that as Ishmael was the son of a bondwoman, so the law brings us into bondage. We learn that just as Isaac was the son of a free woman, so grace brings freedom. Our purpose here is not to look at these truths in detail, but if any one great feature leaps out from the pages of this story, it is how privileged and blessed we are to live in the day of grace and to know that faith is what gives us forgiveness and nearness to God. The law brings into bondage. Grace brings us into liberty. That is the lesson of Galatians chapter 4. And that is the lesson that we see from the difference between the mothers of Ishmael and Isaac. The concluding section of this chapter shows Abraham living in the land of Abimelech and leading a peaceful life. It is noteworthy that when Abraham tells Abimelech of the well which had been violently taken away from him, that Abraham had not recaptured it by force. This was not a time or a place for such action. He is seeking to live at peace with all men. Abraham is settling down. Now that Isaac has been born, he can look forward to long, uninterrupted years of enjoying what had been given him as the fulfillment of divine promise. He could anticipate, with not a little satisfaction, the long years of enjoying Isaac, of seeing him grow and develop and mature. And he could spend these years thinking back to the pathway that had taken him to this point, meditating on and communing with the God who had led him and taught him so much. Surely that was what lay ahead. The turmoil over, the mistakes made, the lessons learned, and now the calm enjoyment of fellowship with God, who had called him his friend. No more trial, no more testing, no more pressure. Only sweet communion and delightful days. Could anyone ask for more? This is the end of Side A of the tape, which has dealt with the subject of faith returning to departure from God. We continue on Side B with the lesson on Genesis chapter 22.